me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I'm out on the road. I'm filming, getting some good information into the camera, which I'll be presenting in the next several months to this audience when I return to New York. Today, we have a power-packed information for you. First up, we're going to give you the latest on why people are dying for satisfaction. Being happy with your doctor is bad for your health. From Eve Smith, Naked Capitalism. Also, remember when I was talking about solar storms and that solar superstorm that no one thought existed, that no one paid a lot of attention to? A small number did. Well, it's going mainstream now. From Florida Today, I'll tell you the latest on this. My guest in the second part of our program today is Richard Loof, and he is a journalist and a founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network. Now, that's an organization devoted to creating movement to connect children to the natural world. And he is also the author of The Nature Principle. He worked for 27 years as a columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Times of London. And we're going to talk about our natural nature deficit disorder and pathways to renaturing ourselves, getting close to nature again, and why that's so important. That'll be an important topic. Time permitting today, I will address Bill O'Reilly and Laura Ingraham on their program last night. I was in a motel, watching, see what they were covering, and anything that seems at all a challenge to America's exceptionalism image, being right about everything all the time, they simply can't handle. And as O'Reilly said, he doesn't want the world to get the wrong impression, nor does Laura. Well, what is the right impression today? Murder, Suicide, and Financial Ruin, How the Class War is Destroying American Lives, from Mark Ames, Consortium News. But specifically, just background that you wouldn't have known otherwise on the fellow who committed the atrocities, the killing of the civilians, SAS Sergeant Roger Bales. There's a whole backstory to him that I think is important and that we should be talking about. 2 years after the British petroleum spill, we're told, go back in the water. Well, okay, remember the movie Jaws? It's a holiday. Go in the water. Yeah. Oh, no, don't go in the Gulf of Mexico. And don't eat anything out of it either. I'll tell you why. Also today, a commentary from Steve Rosenfeld of Alternet. How President Obama became a civil libertarian's nightmare. And $4 for a gallon of gas, that's bad. 4 gallons for a gallon of water, that's really bad. We'll tell you where water is going and why nothing is being done to stop it. As you see, we have a lot to share from different points of view. Let's begin. Have you ever wondered why it costs so much money just to get anything done? If you go into a hospital and you have cancer, by the time you come out, you have spent probably around $30,000 for your first session of treatments. But it's not going to stop there. It generally averages over $200,000. Why? Why does it cost $1,200 to $1,400 just to sleep in a hospital bed for a night? Now, that does not include food or medical care or nursing care, test, nothing. Just to lay in a bed. You could find a suite at the Ritz-Carlton or the Waldorf Astoria that's cheaper. So how did it get this way? Where does the money go? We're going to be doing a special on going through all the major medical practices and procedures and show you what it really should cost and would cost if we were sensible enough to have a charity-based medical system. And if you wanted private care, as they have in Russia, fine. You can go and pay as much as you want. Here are some hospitals. They're for-profit hospitals. Your call, your choice, your right. But for everyone else, here's what it really should cost. And whoa, would that save us over $1 trillion to $2 trillion a year, especially if we added in prevention. There's an important study in the Archives of Internal Medicine which escalates an ongoing row as to whether patient satisfaction is in any way correlated with positive medical outcomes. The answer is yes. The correlation is negative. Now, this finding is of critical importance, not just in understanding why American medicine is a hopeless, costly mess, but also as to a window into how easy it is for buyers of complex services to be hoodwinked by their service provider, whether via the provider being incorrectly confident about his ability to do a good job or having nefarious intent. Let's deal with healthcare as a case first. The study in question was large, 52,000 patients from 2000-2007. The summary comes from the Emergency Physicians blog. Results of the study show that patients who had the highest satisfaction ratings, meaning about spent 9% more on healthcare and prescription medications than patients who had the lowest satisfaction ratings. In addition, the most satisfied patients had a 26% greater risk of death. Let me repeat that. The happy patient was more likely by 26% to die compared to the least satisfied patient. When patients in poor health were excluded, the risk of death for these highly satisfied, smiling patients increased to 44% more than their least satisfied counterparts. In commentary accompanying the article, Dr. Brenda Cervic suggested that discretionary testing is likely to cause the cause of both the increased cost of the increased death in highly satisfied patients. Patients' perceptions, even if medically inappropriate, drive testing and treatment. Antibiotics are harmful in patients with viral infections. And yet a substantial subset of patients are not satisfied without an antibiotic prescription for their colds. But let me put this in perspective. A cold or flu are due to viruses. The rhinovirus, as an example, the adenovirus. There's a whole lot of viruses that will cause your immune system to take a hit. An antibiotic is virtually worthless against them. Now look at the number and tens of millions of Americans that get antibiotic for viral infections that not only are not any good, but also create antibiotic resistance and destroy all the good bacteria in your system, which you really need when you're sick. And yet, a patient's attitude going into a medical encounter based upon what they've seen on television, and then they want that. I want the purple pill. I can't sleep. I want the pill where there's a moth or a butterfly or something in the background flapping its wings and the person gets a good night's sleep. I'm not getting a good night's sleep. Did you read the side effects? No. I didn't hear about side effects. I just care about getting a good night's sleep. So understand that the patient has a great deal to do with what they're given. In large studies, show no link between PSA screening for enlarged prostate or precancerous prostate and either overall survival or prostate cancer survival. However, any patient whose life has been saved by a PSA screen is often quite satisfied. In both scenarios, there's no perceived negative effect from treatment. Patients will recover from their colds with or without antibiotics. Patients likely would not have died from their prostate cancer even if they had been untreated. Why? Because it's a very slow-growing cancer, and most people only get prostate cancer later in life, and so they have already lived out their normal life before the cancer would kill them. But what about the treatment? Well, aggressive treatment with radiation and chemotherapy and radiation pellets, all that can kill you. So the treatment actually becomes more deadly than the cancer. And consider drug research shows a fairly significant placebo effect. So one would assume that satisfied patients would show positive results merely from placebo effect. The fact that the overall results are decidedly negative doesn't merely say that more treatment and more testing are ineffective. It suggests they actually do harm. The article uses the PSA test as an example of ineffective screening. And that's just one example. Now, listeners have to understand that if you believe in your doctor, the doctor's background, their credentials, their experience, that goes a long way in you being satisfied. But it means nothing in the outcome because the results are going to be what the results are. And if you get overtreated, you can end up becoming sickened by the adverse effects from the drugs or treatment itself. We see this all the time with radiation. In particular, I remember a friend of mine who was a photographer his whole life, very nice guy, and his name was Jerry Krupman. And I remember he was sick, and I suggested some alternative therapies, and I gave him a protocol, and I made some calls for him, and I said it'll be a 9-month program, 3 months with each stage. And then I went out. I had an extensive book tour at the time, and then I was ending up at my ranch in Texas for a month. And I didn't hear from him at all. And then he shows up one day at the ranch in Texas, and he was just emaciated. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well," he said, "I made a mistake." And I said, "What was the mistake?" He said, "I went through the standard orthodox therapy, and I didn't do any alternative therapy." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "You remember once we were having a conversation, and you said the cause of disease is not cancer, but it's belief systems that lead to cancer, that lead to bankruptcy, that lead to all these problems. And if you don't focus upon your belief systems, you're not going to really get ahead of being healthy and happy." And he said, "I never paid attention to that until I realized that I went right into the orthodox approach. And they got the cancer out with the surgery, but then they gave me phenomenal amounts of radiation. And I got radiation poisoning, and I can't keep food down, and I'm sick, and they give me a short period of time to live." And this is what he does. He shows up this way. And indeed, even water he couldn't keep down. He'd throw it up. And I did all I could, but couldn't get food into him. Had to do some all kinds of energy work. Finally, he was able to get some soups and nourishment into him. And I suggested that he immediately fly back to the city, and I made arrangements for him to get some intravenous nutrients in him. At least that way it would help his system and also to start the detoxing from the radiation. And it was all done, and I drove him to the airport, and he was all set, and then I was going to meet him back in the city. He never went to the city. He went instead to a hospital in Dallas and died there. Because he couldn't eat, and they didn't think to put him on any of these therapies. So when it happens to someone that's a close, long-term friend, and you see that he believed completely in the therapy he was getting, the orthodox therapy, the trouble is it didn't work. It not only didn't work, it actually cost his death. Well, how many other people get orthodox therapy, and it leads to their death? And yet the system doesn't change at all. And yet when we're getting our treatment from our physician, we want to be optimistic. We want to believe that the doctor is doing the best they can. And we want to believe the therapy they're giving us is scientifically based. The trouble is none of that is true. And this is just an article showing this. And it's interesting because this is one of those devastating articles that if this were to be applied across all medicine, something would have to change. How about the entire paradigm of medicine would change? But it isn't. But at least they know what they're doing wrong. From a College of Medicine and Dentistry, quote, "Exercise in the open air is good for you, but if you want to reap the full benefits, you should head for the coast or the countryside rather than an urban park." That is the conclusion of research of two physicians from the Western Center for Environmental and Human Health of the College of Medicine and Dentistry in the School of Psychology, University of Plymouth. And it goes on to talk about, they found that when you're in nature and you're outdoors, but not around buildings, where you really feel, quote, positive feelings, enjoyment, calmness, refreshment. But that visits to the coast were most beneficial because you're near the water, and visits to urban parks least beneficial, like a Central Park. Now, how many times do people, you know, the only time they get around trees or nature at all is when they go for a run in the morning or bike in Central Park or Prospect Park or one of the parks. But otherwise, they're surrounded by concrete and steel and glass and noise and pollution. And yet you adapt to that. What this is saying, you really need to isolate. You need to get out into nature and spend quality time alone. And then that exercise means all the difference in the world. And when I was looking at this study, I thought about one of the things I really enjoyed about the ranch I had down in Texas was there was a road that started at the edge of the property and went clear down to it dead-ended. And it was about a mile long. But on that road, there were no homes, just farmland. And the farmland was rolling pasture. And it reminded me when I'd be running in the farmlands of France or Italy. You'd see the cows, and there was a windmill, and it was so bucolic, and I would have these wonderful feelings, and the mind would relax, and that's I go out twice a day and do this run up and down this road. So you need to get into real nature. And finally, a poll shows strong voter support for school nutrition standards. 80% of Americans' voters favor national standards that would limit calories, fat, and sodium in snack and a la carte foods sold in school lunches and encourage the consumption of fruits and vegetables and low-fat dairy items. That's according to the latest study. And I believe that what we have to do is, as parents, as concerned citizens, encourage as much information to get into the school system as possible. Take to the Parent Teacher Association, give to the counselors, give to the principal, give to all the student body information on what's wrong with the foods that they're eating, these private vendor foods. They're the worst foods, they're the cheapest foods, they're garbage foods, and we all know that. And what we could do in their place, we could have wonderful, healthy foods that are tasty. And there's no shortages of examples of this. Alice Waters out on the West Coast and down in New Orleans, I visited those schools. They even have gardens and greenhouses growing foods that the students then sell and consume. I went to a market on a Saturday in March in New Orleans. The school was closed, but in the backyard there were these greenhouses, completely passive, heated, meaning no electricity. They were about 8 foot high, maybe 10 foot across, about 20 feet long, stacked with microgreens. And outside there was broccoli and cauliflower. And then I asked someone in the neighborhood, do you know where this is sold? Oh, at the farmer's market. So I got to the farmer's market, and sure enough, there was a stall with the students and teachers selling organically grown local produce and then splitting the profit. The teachers and the students would share. And I thought that was really neat, and we should be doing that in every school in America. Every school in America should have solar panels on the roof and have greenhouses and sustainable. And when you learn to do this, and then you're serving the foods in your cafeteria and you're making juices from it, think of how much more impactful that will be to the student. So this is something that we could do. And microgreens don't take long to grow. Sprouts you can grow 3 to 8 days. Microgreens in, 20 days. Full heads of lettuce in 35 to 45 days. So you could have food growing 12 months a year, and that would be a big plus. And that's how we can change over the school system. Now, this past year and last year, I was invited to lecture for the full school student body in their gymnasium. I think there were 12 or 1,300 students. And they were really into health. They were very aware of junk foods versus healthy foods, because a lot of the teachers there listen to this program and have shown the drugging of our children and other documentaries that show them what they should be doing, right? And they're very open to this, and as are members of the faculty. So it's easier in those schools where you have someone who's raising other people's conscience. Just keep feeding the articles. Here's what's bad. Here's what's good. And if any school out there, or any administrator in any school, or any teacher that wants to get more information, when I come back to this city in about 6 weeks, I will be happy to offer how to change over a standard school meal program to a healthy one that kids will love. All right? And I would also do that for charter schools as well. Big doses of vitamin C may lower blood pressure. This is from Science Daily. This is from Johns Hopkins. Quote, taking large doses of vitamin C may moderately reduce blood pressure, according to analysis of years of research by Johns Hopkins scientists. Our research suggests a modest blood pressure lowering effect with vitamin C supplementation. Okay, well, that's good. And that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. But that was only with 500 milligrams. Try 5,000 milligrams and watch how that blood pressure comes down. Now to an issue of the day. First, our environmental issue, and then our issue. Then time for you to talk back. Lou Ann will have a few questions, then our guest. This is about environmental issues. It's been, about 2 years since the British petroleum oil spill? And we're told that the Gulf of Mexico is vibrant, is good. Jump in the water. Eat the crayfish and the shrimp. No, don't. Here are the facts. From the New York Times, Gulf dolphins exposed to oil are seriously ill. From MSNBC, Gulf shrimp scarce in season. Mother Jones, eyeless shrimp are being found all over the Gulf. New York Times, oil spill affected Gulf fish's cell function, study finds. CBS, experts, British petroleum spill likely cause of sick Gulf fish. And then Pensacola News article, sick fish. And then Agency France, a press, mystery illnesses plague Louisiana oil spill crews. Sea turtle deaths are up along the Gulf, joining dolphins' deaths. Submarine dive finds oil, dead sea life at bottom of Gulf of Mexico. AP. British petroleum oil spill the culprit for slow death of deep sea coral, scientists say. A recent report also notes that there are flesh-eating bacteria in tar balls of British petroleum oil washing up all around the Gulf beaches. And all that lovely Corexit dispersant sprayed on water, land and air, it inhibits the ability of microbes to break down oil and allows oil and other chemicals to speed past the normal barriers of human skin. And that means it can cause serious infections. And there are 5 chemicals in that can cause cancer, 33 different chemicals in that dispersant that cause skin irritation, rashes, and burns. 33 chemicals are linked to eye irritations. 11 are suspected of being respiratory toxins. 10 are suspected of kidney toxins. 8 are suspected of known to be toxic to aquatic organisms. So don't eat the food at all because you could be consuming some really toxic substances and you don't need to do that. And finally, when Barack Obama took office, he was a civil liberties community's great hope. Obama was a former constitutional law professor. He pledged to shutter the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, an open and transparent government. But he's become a civil libertarian's nightmare. A supposedly liberal president who insisted on expanding and fortifying many of the Bush administration's worst policies, lending bipartisan support for a more intrusive and authoritarian federal government. It started with the 9/11 attacks, Within 1 week, Congress, including many liberals, gave the White House blanket authority to wage a war on the terrorist. A month after that, Congress passed the USA Patriot Act, authorizing many anti-terrorism measures, including expanding surveillance. By just mid-November, the White House ordered creation of military tribunals to try terrorists who were not U.S. citizens. Bush quickly expanded covert operations, creating a shadow arrest, interrogation, and detention system based at Guantanamo that violated international law and evaded domestic oversight. And while the Supreme Court eventually ruled that detainees have some rights, the precedent that the Constitution does not restrict how a president conducts an endless war against a stateless enemy was firmly planted. In response, groups like the American Civil Liberties Union proposed reforms to the president that he could make. What few anticipated was how he would embrace, expand, and institutionalize many of Bush's war on terror excesses. President Obama now has the power that Bush never had. Foremost is he can and has ordered the killing of U.S. citizens abroad. Like Bush, he has asked the Justice Department to draft secret memos authorizing his actions without going before a federal court or disclosing them. Obama has continued indefinite detentions at Guantanamo, but also brought the policy ashore by signing the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, which authorizes the military to arrest and indefinitely detain anyone suspected of assisting terrorists, even citizens. That policy, codifying how the Bush treated Jose Padilla, a citizen who was arrested in a bomb plot after landing at Chicago Airport in 2002 and was transferred from civil to military custody, upends the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act ban on domestic military deployment. Meanwhile, more than a decade after the 9/11 attacks, Washington's wartime posturing has trickled down into many areas of domestic activity, even as some foreign policy experts say the world is a much safer place than it was 20 years ago, as measured by the growth in free market economies and democratic governments. Domestic law enforcement has been militarized, as most visibly seen by the tactics used against the Occupy protest and also against suspected illegal immigrants, who are treated with brute force and have limited access to judicial review before being deported. One of Bush's biggest civil liberties breaches was spying on virtually all Americans using their telecommunications starting in 2003, but he also had expanded that. Congress authorized the effort in 2006. 2 years later, it granted legal immunity to the telecom firms helping Bush, a bill Obama voted for. The National Security Agency is now building its largest data processing center ever, which Wired.com's James Bamforth reports will go beyond the public internet to grab data, but also reach password-protected networks. The federal government continues to require that computer makers and big websites provide access for domestic surveillance purposes. More crucially, the National Security Agency is increasingly relying upon private firms to mine data, because unlike the government, it does not need a search warrant. The Constitution only limits the government searches and seizures. The government's endless wartime footing is also seen in its war on whistleblowers. President Obama has continued cases brought by Bush, such as going after the leaker in the warrantless wiretapping story broken by New York Times 2005, as well as the WikiLeaks case, prosecution of Bradley Manning, and others for allegedly mishandling classified materials related to the war on terrorism. Its suppression of war-related information given to journalists extends overseas, where the State Department this month was blocked a visa for a Pakistani critic from speaking to the U.S. The White House has also recently pressured Yemen's leader to jail the reporter who exposed U.S. drone strikes. Meanwhile, the administration has stonewalled Freedom of Information Act requests, particularly the Justice Department, which has issued the secret wartime memos. How bad is it? Anthony Romero, ACLU executive director, exclaimed that Obama, quote, disgusted him. Meanwhile, the most hawkish Bush administration official has defended and praised Bush. Last summer, liberal lawyer journalist Glenn Greenwald tallied a list of Bush's warrior endorsements. Jack Goldsmith, a former Department of Justice official who approved the torture and domestic spying efforts, wrote in the New York New Republic, that Obama actually was waging a more effective war on terror than Bush. Quote, the new administration has copied most of Bush's program, has expanded it, and has narrowed only a bit. Almost all of the Obama changes have been at the level of packaging, argumentation, symbol, and rhetoric. Bush's final CIA director, General Michael Hayden, whose confirmation Obama opposed as a senator, told CNN there was a, quote, powerful continuity between the 43rd and 44th presidents. All of these civil liberties issues, executive authority to assassinate any citizen, unlimited detention without charges at Guantanamo, authority to deploy the military domestically to arrest and indefinitely detain any suspects, a parallel due process that is outside the judicial branch, the expansion of the surveillance state, the increased militarization of local police and federal agencies, especially the ICE, the increasingly punitive treatment of protesters, including strip searches, the war on whistleblowers and others, are all very complicated. The details are filled with shades of gray. Bradley Manning's harsh treatment, for example, sought to be tied to the White House's fear that the vast WikiLeaks cache contained references to the pursuit of Osama bin Laden before his assassination and could have altered al-Qaeda. Better data mining analysis could have detected 9/11 attacks. The Patriot Act's defenders, past and present, have repeatedly argued. But from a civil liberties perspective, Obama has more than chipped away at freedom from federal intrusion. The underlying problem is the tactics and values forged in foreign wars have seeped into domestic policy. Quote, we are witnessing the bipartisan normalization and legalization and legitimization of a national security state, unquote, says Jack Balkin, a liberal Yale University Law School professor. Well, and there are dangers. And we are not paying attention to the fact that we've had so many of our rights guaranteed under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights gone. So when are we going to wake up? I don't believe that the average American will wake up or wants to, nor the media. But for those of us who are awake, and that's why we're listening, that's why we're reading, that's why we're acting on this information, we are concerned. Just remember that when you go to vote for someone. And that's why I pay attention to third-party candidates who would repeal the Patriot Act, repeal all these acts, and give us back our freedoms. I'm Gary Nall. Those are my thoughts. What are yours? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest, Richard Louv, in just a moment and talk about our cultural nature deficit disorder and pathways for renaturing ourselves. But before that, let's go in to say hello to Lou Ann Panessi, who's taking your emails to see what questions you have, and we'll address those. Also, let me quickly give you two pieces of information. For those of you who do not have internet access, for those of you who may be out driving and can't be near a land-based station and you'd still like to hear the program, no problem. With the new technology, you can call a number and listen to this show anywhere in North America. Call 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. And for those of you who want the latest information on all of the important progressive issues in some 37 different categories, hundreds of articles per day, dwarfing the Huffington Post and some of the other blog sites, because we have people working about 18 hours a day just collecting data that has a progressive slant with positive results. We'll have about 10 million page views alone just this year. So people are coming and people are looking at more pages and more information. This coming guest week, we have tomorrow the groundbreaking psychological and scientific evidence supporting the restorative powers of our natural world. That's my guest now. And then we have Monday, we have Dr. Martha Herbert. She is a professor at Harvard Medical School and neurological pediatrician at Massachusetts General Hospital. And we're going to be talking about natural and alternative advances in the treatment of autism. Then on Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to talk about America's epidemic of mental illness and the corruption of psychiatry with Martha Rosenberg, an award-winning journalist, and Dr. Bruce Levine and Dr. George Kohler. The next day, the last myth. What is the rapid rise of the apocalyptic thinking telling us about America and why it confuses our abilities and motivation to deal with factual challenges such as climate change and a breakdown in our social fabric? Matthew Barrett Gross, former communications director and visionary behind Howard Dean's presidential campaign, will be there. And then we have our conversations with remarkable minds. We'll have our national debt, how we got there, and what it forebodes for the future with Professor Simon Johnson, the Ronald Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT Sloan School for Management, and a member of the Congressional Budget Office Panel on Economic Advisors. And then the second guest on the same day, the whole hour will be on Conversations with Remarkable Minds, will be with John Perkins, author and visionary behind Confessions and the Economic Hitman, and a look at behind the corporatocracy responsible for the global financial meltdown and their continued strategy to bring down the world to their level and keep it. So as you see, we have a lot of important topics. Lou Ann Panessa, your turn.
Hi, Gary. You've been getting an awful lot of emails from people who are standing behind all of the different topics that you cover. And there are two things that come up. One woman said here that you know that she knows that you're working on this film with genetic engineering. People are really going off the charts, commenting about your work with vaccines, homeless vets, the dangers of nuclear power plants. And the question that comes up from several listeners, especially from the Pacifica stations, it keeps resounding. Why have the Pacifica stations not joined in? That's the first question. The second one comes from this guy, Kyle, who is saying that he's so impressed with how many films you can do in a year. And he's asking, how many films are you working on for the coming year, and when will the ones that you're working on now be available?
All right. Thank you. To Kyle, I'm currently on the road working on three separate documentaries, and I'll tell you only about one. One of them is about manufacturing madness, how we have allowed ourselves to believe that just normal behavior should be reclassified as psychotic, delusional, or something that has been given a diagnostic and pathological stamp, a moniker, and hence treated aggressively. So that's one. The other two I cannot discuss that are of a highly sensitive nature, but they're all on social issues, as the drugging of our children, knocking on the devil's door, deadly nuclear legacy, and all the others I have done are about. I will have two premieres of brand new feature documentaries on the same night in June when I get back. Specific dates are yet to be determined, and no one's aware of these two. And I will be working on two additional films in the next 12 months, including the 12 tipping points, examining all the different tipping points on environmental issues. I've been working on this for 7 years. And how many have tipped, will tip no matter what we do, and how many still can be in some way dealt with in a positive sense. That's it. To your first question, I don't know what goes on in the minds of people at Pacifica. All I know is that they have their own agenda, and more often than not, it deals with a person's need to keep control over their job or their show, and this entire lack of community and lack of joint efforts. As you've seen, not once have you seen any of the producers' management at our Stop Hydrofracking rally in front of the governor's office, Stop Nuclear Power and Close Down Indian Point in front of Indian Point power plants, Stop Genetic Engineering, or at least label it, with our March on Washington with 7,000 of our listeners. Not once. nothing, yet they've been made aware of it. But that's their right. Unfortunately, they should pay attention to the Arbitrons. They've lost over 80% of their entire audience, the largest drop in audience in American history. There's no way to survive this unless someone puts on the brakes, reaffirms itself towards some positive progressive issues, and then starts looking in the way that we can empower people. And throwing everything behind Occupy is a big mistake. Not that Occupy is a mistake in and of itself, but putting all your apples there instead of all the other causes that are important. And I hope that they turn this around because we all want to see it thrive and survive. But that's up to them now. But we're going ahead and we have our own issues and we're willing to work cooperatively. And hopefully at some point they may get this message. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Now to my guest, Richard. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
I'd given your background a little earlier and the fact that you're the author of The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age. Richard, first I welcome you back. The last time you were a guest was several years ago. So perhaps you could begin by first summarizing briefly the condition you first coined, nature deficit disorder. And then because you first observed this condition in children, please expand on how you witness nature deficit disorder in adults in our society at large and what are its main symptoms. And from there, segue into what you believe are the fundamental props or the artifices of contemporary American technology and infotainment culture that most prevalent of that most often are impacting us, and hence we don't see ourselves as part of nature anymore, and we don't exist within the web of life, and that keeps us stuck in seeing humanity as something separate from us. Could you address these, please?
Sure. Well, first, nature deficit disorder was a term that I coined for the book Last Child in the Woods, and the subtitle of that was Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And that was, I was very careful every time I talk about it in both books, both Last Child and in the new one, The Nature Principle, to say that that's not a known medical diagnosis. Maybe it should be, but it is a way to begin to talk about the price we pay as a species for being alienated from a connection to the natural world. And in Last Child, and then I extended this greatly in The Nature Principle, the new book, which is as much about or more about adults, the second book, as about kids, but it's about the rest of us. To look at the rapidly emerging body of scientific evidence that suggests just how great that connection is for us, whether it's attention deficit disorder, the symptoms of attention deficit disorder get much better for kids with just a little bit of contact with nature, or whether it's psychological health, a relief from stress and depression for people of all ages, or whether it's physical health, which translates into mental health as well. You know, studies have been done comparing people on a treadmill in an indoor gym compared to people doing green exercise, going on a hike or gardening, something like that. In both of those groups, they're expending the same amount of energy, burning the same number of calories, and yet the people who are doing that exercise outdoors get even better in their psychological well-being and the blood pressure, et cetera. So there's this margin of improvement that comes from connecting with nature that even when we do just basic exercises that we don't really fully understand. Science doesn't understand it. It really hasn't looked at this very well until quite recently. So what's emerging and what I write about a lot in The Nature Principle is really a vision of a different kind of society in which, what if we were as immersed in nature every day as we are in technology where we live, work, learn, and play. It's not only about wilderness. Environmentalism is not only about wilderness. It's also about our cities. As of 2008, more people will live in cities in the world, or lived in cities in the world, than in the countryside. That's a first in human history. That's a huge moment in human history, and it's largely unremarked. By 2030, two-thirds of human beings will live in cities. What that means is one of two things. Either human beings will gradually or rapidly lose their kind of daily meaningful connection with the natural world, or it means the beginning of a new kind of city. I'd like to choose door B. I mean, I think that there's an exciting conversation to be had. I'm speaking today at DePaul University about that, how important it is to have a different vision of the future than this dystopic vision that we seem to be accepting.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight. Since we try to address health issues frequently on this program daily, would you update us on some of the more recent scientific research and studies that have been performed that gives sound evidence for the healing properties of simply being connected with nature and the lowering of health risks and curing of illnesses, especially those we call mental disorders, and then speak a bit about what is meant by the pain of removal from the cherished natural place?
Well, let me start with that last thing. There's a word for that last thing that was coined by a fine researcher in Australia, and solastalgia is the word. And it's a kind of deep sense of nostalgia, of sadness when nature around us, when a familiar environment, particularly a natural environment, is being destroyed around us, is disappearing. And that this hurts us far more than we know. It hurts us psychologically. It hurts us, in a way, physically, because of the impact of psychological health on physical health. The studies, many of them, however, are focused on the positive benefits. For instance, studies of people who have a view of a natural landscape as opposed to a man-made landscape from their hospital bed. Those patients get well faster. That's research that was done some time ago. And it's accepted by many hospitals. Many hospitals are putting in healing gardens and focusing on the view that their patients have, specifically because their patients heal faster. In terms of mental health, there is actually more research on mental health than there is on physical health. But some of that research is I think, really suggests the kind of cities, the kind of neighborhoods, the kind of lives we might have if we began to think this way. For example, the studies of parks, urban parks. The urban parks with the highest level of biodiversity are the parks that show the most positive impact on human psychological well-being for the people that use those parks. So, you know, this idea that somehow cities should be the antithesis to biodiversity, I think we have to challenge that. You know, what if we were thinking about designing cities, neighborhoods, workplaces, homes, but whole cities as engines of biodiversity? And we can do this. I've got some examples that I talk about that illustrate that. But the bottom line here is that we do ourselves great harm by disconnecting from nature, and we can do ourselves great good by beginning to change the environment we live in and not only preserve nature. One of the basic ideas of the nature principle of the book is conservation is no longer enough. Now we need to create nature. As strange as that sounds, it can be done.
Okay, how?
Well, let me give you one example.
Let me just put this in a larger context.
Yeah.
How can that be done when there are those on the more radical side of the environmental movement, such as Derek Jensen, who you know, in the U.S., and Paul Kingsnorth in the United Kingdom, who would argue there is no natural compatibility between civilization's modern technology and our being part of the web of life. In fact, they would argue technology is the greatest foe to a natural environmental consciousness. So that is the context, if you would please to answer this question.
Sure. They may be right in the current context, but we need to change the context. One of the ideas in the nature principle is, we have to probably accept the fact that technology is going to be with us for a while. I'm talking to you on a telephone, you know, and that is probably not going to go away anytime soon. So one of the basic ideas in the nature principle is a kind of equation. The more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need. That's why it's not enough only to preserve what we've got. We have to preserve every square inch of wilderness. But we also have to change our cities to become, as I said, engines of biodiversity. There's this false dichotomy in which people believe that we have to choose between viewing nature as something that we use and that is good for us, et cetera, or choosing to protect it only as wilderness. We don't have to choose. We shouldn't choose. That's a false dichotomy. We actually need both. You know, we live in a culture in which everything seems to be illegitimate unless it's polarized. We've got to stop doing that. An example of this kind of thinking, this newer kind of thinking that I'm supporting, is just a couple weeks ago I was speaking in Charlottesville, and Bill McDonough's business partner, a German, was in the audience. Bill McDonough, as many of your listeners know, wrote, along with his partner, the German business partner, wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle that argues that everything carbon-based can be recycled and must be recycled, from the carpets we walk on to the chairs we sit on. And it's a powerful argument that he makes, and Bill McDonough is kind of the Einstein of green architecture. He's been a hero of mine for a long time. So his business partner, came up to me after the speech and grabbed me, and we went there the next morning. I didn't know that McDonough was headquartered in Charlottesville. So we spent the morning talking with McDonough, and a design caught my eye, a drawing of a building that they're working on, and it's a hospital in Spain, and McDonough rolled it up and sent it to me later. The picture shows a kind of a three-sided building. One side is a green wall. Another side is solar panels done in the colors of a butterfly that is threatened, is going to go extinct in that region unless somebody does something about it. The whole wall is solar panels. The third wall is a vertical farm that is producing food for the people in the hospital. So that building is not only saving energy, it's also producing energy in the form of food. It's also producing energy in the form of the well-being and the health of the people in that hospital, who will get well faster because of the presence of that nature in that design. But it goes even further. The bottom floor of this proposed hospital is all glassed in. Anybody who walks into that hospital, butterflies will light on them. The butterfly that is threatened with extinction, they're going to turn the bottom floor of that building into a butterfly factory. And bring in the chrysalises, and apparently they open in a synchronized way, like once a week. And once a week they're going to make a community ritual, so they let loose the butterflies. They're not going to stop there. They're going to go to the surrounding schools, the workplaces, you know, other employers, private homeowners, et cetera, and say, you can do this too. We're going to bring back this butterfly as a community. We're going to start with this hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a metaphor. That building alone won't do a lot, but that is a metaphor. What if our cities could be like that? What if the future could be like that? And again, it'll take the shape, you know, many different shapes. But we have to begin to think about not only conserving nature, but also creating life, of giving birth, actually, to new nature.
Richard Liu, once again, terrific information, and a lot more of it in the book, The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age. Richard Liu, LOUV.com is the website. Thank you very much, Richard. We look forward to having you on again.
Oh, I look forward to it, too. Thanks.
All the best. Now, I don't know if I'll have time to get some calls, but very quickly, here's our special of the day. And keep in mind, when I think about a special, I think about something that I believe can really make a difference in someone's life, their health. And we all know we should be eating cruciferous vegetables. There's no controversy about that. There's also hundreds of studies in the scientific literature supporting why these cruciferous vegetables are so important. And there are a couple companies that have some cruciferous vegetable products out there, and they're good. Before I created mine, I recommended it. And then I started realizing that it's the amount of a cruciferous vegetables that you allow someone to consume that makes the difference, and the variety. For example, there's some products out there that have 100 milligrams of broccoli, and I think also some kale, about 100 milligrams, and that's good. But compared to what? Well, now there's something to compare it to. I've created what is called cruciferous stuff. It is 500 grams. That's a big container. 5,000 milligrams per serving is coca. Broccoli, 750 milligrams. That's industrial dosing. Collard greens that you never think about. They're cruciferous, 500 milligrams. Brussels sprouts, 500 milligrams. Watercress, 500 milligrams. Kale, 500 milligrams. Mustard seed, one of the most powerful, single, most perfect foods in all of nature, 500 milligrams. Apple pectin, 500 milligrams. So you see, this is what made the difference. Putting the potency in the product, getting it natural. It is juiced and dried at room temperature. It's a living food. Then adding in turnips, arugula, turmeric, horseradish, radish sprouts, daikon radish, ginger root. And I think there's about natural caffeine, about 20 milligrams from the coca. So that's it. I mean, there's nothing else in there. That's it. There's no 40 calories. There's no fat. There's it's just, to me, everyone should be having cruciferous stuff every day. Now, why should you have it? That I can't tell you, because I'd be making a claim. Should you have it? Oh, you bet. I travel, and I have shipped to different locations before I get there. Packages of red stuff, green stuff, berry blast, greens and grains, supremacy powder, super muscle, cruciferous stuff, you bet. And I take a lot of it. Cruciferous stuff, it's our special today, and I believe that it's a big discount. Yeah, it is, the deepest discount we've ever given, $59.95. Call this number, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Again, cruciferous stuff, what all of you should be consuming every day. And this is, there's nothing like it. Go on the internet, look in your health food store. You will find nothing that's even close to this. This raised the bar so high. Cruciferous stuff. Get it. Special price. 877-627-5065. And if you want to know why you should take it, then go look at all the science behind each and every one of these ingredients. Let's quickly say hello to one of our listeners who's been standing by from Vic from Chester, New Jersey. Hi, Vic. Vic, your turn. You're on.
Yes. Hi, Gary. I was just listening to the program this afternoon, and the segment on Mexico, and when he brought up the drug issue, I had contact with people that spent time traveling in Mexico and talking to local people. Some of the people feel that they don't want to have the drugs legalized. And I guess they're making too much money off this. Also, there was the issue some months ago where the U.S. government had set up a shipment of arms to Mexico as a sting operation to see if they could somehow, you know,
yeah, the Fast and Furious.
Figure out where
we're going to have a whole discussion on legalization of drugs, Vic. And last call, let's go over to Eugene, Oregon, and say hello to then Humboldt, California. Dave, you're the last call.
Well, it's Dave, and new listener to your program. I'm very active with the Occupy movement. One of the things that's been troubling me, I believe the neocons that we have in power that run our government got there by cheating, by rigging elections. I believe the whole group of them invades our computers, our phones. I don't know what we're going to do about this, but it troubles me much, and I feel we got to make it known as best we can and try to do what we can about it. Get rid of electronic voting, for one thing.
I absolutely agree with you, Dave, and we will be doing more on this in depth as a part of our regular programming. Thank you very much for listening in, Dave, and we support your efforts. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Stay tuned for Mike Fader, always informative, always interested in what's happening to you. And he'll be taking your calls in a moment, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a nice day.